Okay, Kimberly, let's see who we have on the participating, and we'll call the meeting to order. You want to do a roll call, please?
Yes. Justice Hardesty?
Here.
Justice Silver?
Here.
Justice Stiglich?
Here.
John Arascotta?
Here.
Judge Freeman?
I'm here.
Judge Herndon? Darren Imlay?
Here.
Mark Jackson?
Here.
Christopher Lawley?
Here.
Luke Pringleman? I think I saw him. Lisa Rasmussen?
Here.
Judge Shirley? John Springate? And Jonelle Thomas?
Here.
We have a quorum.
I think I show Luke left the call. Maybe he's coming back on. We'll pick him up if he does, of course, for the minutes. thanks everybody for being available today. Hopefully this particular meeting won't take too long. We're down, I think, to the final set of rules or discussions so that we can get this matter on to the Supreme Court. Are there any edits to the meeting summary of September 2nd? All right, hearing none, we'll accept those. And let's turn to, pardon me, Rule 4 under Tab 2, if you would.
Justice Hardesty, this is Christopher Lawley. Before, can I just sort of ask a question?
I'm sorry, Chris, could you repeat that? There was an interruption. Are you still there?
I am. Although I can't see anybody else.
Right.
I can hear you. I can ask my question if you'd like me to.
Yes, go ahead. And Kimberly, are you able to see all of us? Kimberly?
Sorry, I was on mute. I can't see anybody, but I did contact Jason to fix it.
All right. I don't want to have to repeat this, so let's quickly go through, make sure everybody is, it looks like everybody is connected to the call. Many are muted, however. So we'll go ahead and pose the question, Chris, and then see what the issue is.
So just going through the materials that were distributed, it appears to me, and I just want to make sure that I'm on the same page as you are and everybody else is. So it appears that Rule 4H was moved to Rule 6 originally, and then Rule 5 is now the new Rule 6, and Rule 5 is entitled Release.
Recording has started.
Everybody came back. And Rule 5 is entitled Release and Detention Pending Judicial Proceedings. So
recording has stopped.
So as I understand it, what was our discussion centered on Rule 5H is essentially now moved into Rule 5.
Actually, our discussion had been centered around Rule 8H.
8H, I'm sorry, Justice, you're correct.
And that had been postponed several times. And that subject, as I mentioned in previous meetings, on pretrial release and detention, has now been inserted into Rule 5 as its own subject.
Thank you.
You'll recall from our meeting last time, we had voted up Rule 4 but I requested input to see whether and express my interest in moving some of the provisions from Rule 4 to new Rule 5. And that's what you see happening here with an addition to Rule 4. And as to Rule 4A, prior to circulating this, I consulted with Chief Judge Bell and Chief Judge Freeman to secure their approval of this language, which they advised me they approve. And they advised me that in the eighth judicial district, that is already being accomplished. And in the second judicial district, they would have sufficient time while these rules are being considered to accomplish and satisfy the requirements contained in A of Rule 4. The only other difference, as I mentioned, from Rule 4 was we pulled out what had been referenced in subsection C1, and it now forms the first part of Rule 5, which is under tab 3. If you want to, we can consider the rules together. That's fine too. We have already voted on, in effect, the language that was in B and C and D of Rule 4 with the additions I made to subsection 1 and 2, inserting guilty but mentally ill, if that comes about in connection with either a plea of guilty or a subsequent sentence. So I'll open up any questions or comments that anybody may have regarding the revised Rule 4 and the revision to Rule 5. I just would finish one more point on Rule 5. I added subsection B, which is consistent with previous conversations we've had on the committee. That requires motion. We're dealing with Goodness. I'll try to step back, or I'm not sure what's going on here, but we are dealing with rules for the district court, not all that takes place in the justice court. And in that regard, what is contained in Rule B assumes there has been or addresses what transpires following a defendant's initial post-arrest individualized detention determination. I will mention to all of you that I have a meeting later this afternoon with the Limited Jurisdiction Judges Association representatives, who have expressed an interest in the formulation of rules of criminal procedure for limited jurisdiction courts. We'll see how that proceeds, and we'll probably take that request up with the that group and with the Supreme Court to see what they want to do in that regard. So are there any questions or observations or concerns about the edits that have been made to either Rule 4 or Rule 5?
Justice Hardesty, this is Christopher Lawley. With respect to Rule 4, Section A scheduling, I really pulled all of the team chiefs in the criminal division in our office to see if these time frames were reasonable. And for example, in our outlying team, that team services the justice courts in Moapa, Moapa Valley, Laughlin, Boulder City, all of the sort of rural tracks. And I am told that bindovers at a minimum are taking 5 days. So defendant appears in court on Monday, and if he or she is bound over, the soonest they will be in district court is the following Monday or later. So I'm concerned with A1 subsection I. And I didn't really dig too deeply into the out of custody folks. I'm really not sure where that lands. I don't know. Maybe Jonelle or Darren have a better idea of that. I also inquired with respect to getting folks here from the prison, which would address section A13. And what I'm told is that amount of time should usually be enough time, but not always enough time, depending on where in the state a particular inmate is housed. If they're housed in the northern part of the state, it could take longer than 3 weeks. So I guess my comment is that I am very concerned about the time frames that are contained in the rule based upon the feedback that I've received from our team chiefs. These are the folks who are in the trenches doing the work. And then sort of a related question is, what is the remedy if the time frame in Rule 4A, if those various time frames are not complied with? So what if it takes, the rule says 3 days to appear? What if it takes 5 days, or what if it takes 7 judicial days? What's the remedy? Is the remedy release from custody? So those are some of the observations and questions and comments that I had.
I wanted to put this out here for everyone's discussion. Chris, your information is different than your chief judge, who believes you're satisfying 1I, regardless of where they come from. I don't know. Unfortunately, Chief Judge Bell had a family, a death in a family, and is not available today to comment on this. As to the other time frames, she thought that those were in compliance. So, in fact, she actually indicated that on the in custodies, they were getting done within 2 days. So that's the
that's
email
true for
I
the,
have from her.
I'm sorry, that is true in the Las Vegas Justice Court, but that's only one of our justice courts. Mm-hmm. That is not the case for the other justice courts.
Okay. Mark, you had a question?
I do. Thank you. I agree with everything that Chris said, and I just wanted to add to it. Kind of throughout the entire process of this, I thought that we were kind of on task about where we have conflicts with the law, or there's an existing statute that deals with it, why are we creating a rule that conflicts with that particular statute? And the legislature has already enacted laws dealing with when informations are to be filed and when first appearances are going to be. Under current NRS 173.035, the prosecution, we have 15 days after a person is bound over following a preliminary hearing or a waiver of preliminary hearing. We have 15 days to file an information. And this rule would cut 12 of those days out and conflict with an existing statute. There are times where we need, frankly, all 15 of those days. So I don't think that even in the rural jurisdictions that we can hit these days, the 3, 10, and the 15.
What about the statutes? I think you'd agree are silent with respect to information, or excuse me, first appearances on indictments, right?
Correct.
Okay. Anybody else have any comment or question? Yes, Darren?
I'm kind of reading Rule 4 and 5 in conjunction, because when I'm looking at Rule 5, if a person's indicted, then they would appear in and they're in custody. They appear in district court 3 days later for their initial arraignment or initial appearance.
Right.
If there was a Valdez-Jimenez hearing in justice court, then, and nothing's changed, then the presumption is that would stay the same, right?
Yep.
Likewise, if in part B, if a warrant was issued and they came back, as long as the conditions are the same, everything, the presumption is everything would stay the same. The only time that Valdez-Jimenez would kick in would be as if there was no criminal complaint filed, no justice court proceedings, it was just a straight indictment. They would be entitled to a Valdez-Jimenez hearing at the initial arraignment or initial appearance within 3 days if they're in custody after the arrest, right?
Right. That's what it says. And that's okay. What we voted on last time.
And basically, so basically, we're at this point, we're saying a prompt hearing is three judicial days.
That's right. At least in district court.
Right. Right. I just want to make sure I was reading those. So if a motion is had to be filed, it would only be because conditions of the original detention review or detention setting were changed.
That's right.
Just want to make sure it's clear on those.
That motion would have to be filed in writing.
Right. But only if the conditions have changed without the hearing.
Yes. Well, the request can be made. We went over that last meeting, you'll recall. And there would be changed circumstances, in which case that would be presented to the judge on return of the indictment.
But that would be my question then, is if there were changed circumstances, defense counsel probably wasn't going to be there when the conditions were changed. Would we then have to file a motion to get the original conditions back?
Yes. Okay.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Well, Justice Hardesty, this is Judge Shirley. I do have some questions.
Sure.
My first question is under A1I. It says within 3 days of arrest for an individual for an in custody defendant. Most of the time, when we're getting these, they're in custody already. They're not rearresting. So that language is kind of awkward to me, but. They're in the rural jurisdiction in the 11th, the 7th, and the 5th, it's probably going to be impossible to do it within three judicial days because of our travel schedules. And we would struggle even with the 15 days that the state has to file their information. And then in custody is what I see with the prison is if it's a pretty serious crime, they will move those defendants to other parts of the state. And so while the county is here in Pershing, while the prison's in Pershing, it might take us time to get somebody from Ely or from Vegas. Those would be two of my concerns in addition to what Mr. Jackson said.
Let me just clarify one thing, Judge. It's three judicial days of arrest for an in-custody defendant charged by indictment.
Or the date of bindover.
The date of bindover. So if you have someone who's in custody, when they're bound over, it's three judicial days after that.
Okay. But I was just unclear on that, I guess.
Yeah, but I get your point in terms of how quickly you might be able to move. Now, let's take those separately. Probably should have broken these up in the first place. Let's take the issue of an indictment. It's rare in the rural counties, but it does happen occasionally, I guess, where you will have an in custody who is indicted and has previously been in the justice court system.
Correct.
Separately, though, most of the cases in the rural counties, as I understand it, come to the district court by way of bindover.
Correct.
In those circumstances where the individual is in custody, aren't they in custody? I'm not talking about the prison folks. I'm talking about in custody in a county jail.
Correct.
Aren't they in custody and available to the district court within 3 judicial days after the bind over?
They totally are. Agree with that. But the 3 days, the problems in the 3 jurisdictions I mentioned is we don't have our lawn motions there every week.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we're doing it 3 days of the bind over, it would be very difficult for the judges to do that, because we won't be in the county where the arraignment's to be held.
Sure. I understand.
And then you do have, you know, because it not only does, as I understand it, not only does the state have 15 days, but the justices court can equally take up to, I think, 15 days to get their materials up, their file up. They don't do it automatically always. So I think 3 days would be pushing it pretty hard in these multi-county rural jurisdictions.
So a defendant in custody in a rural county, here, I want to make sure I understand this, would be facing 15 days to get their paperwork to you, and on top of that, another 15 days for the DA's office to get their complaint ready?
No. No, the DA has 15 days period, and the justice of court sometimes take, normally they're really quick, but sometimes they, I think they have a period of time there. I haven't reviewed that statute for a while, but they have a period of time to get it up. It's within the time frame that the DA has to file the information.
Okay.
They can file the information before the justice's court has done anything.
Okay.
Vice versa.
So we're talking about the same 15-day period. I just want to be sure about that.
Yes, and I don't think there would be a problem if the rule said that once there's a bind over, the justice's court has a duty to at least notify the district court in some manner. I'm not saying what that manner has to be, so that then we could get it on the calendar as quickly as possible.
Okay.
And I'm in favor of a rule that sets some time limits, because oftentimes when we're trying to schedule it with the attorneys, sometimes they're recalcitrant in giving us a date. Mm-hmm. But it would be nice if we said, well, this is the rule. You file a stip with your client signing it, agreeing to waive his right to have that hearing within the time frame. So I'm in favor of the rule. I just think it has to be tweaked a little bit.
So let's separate these. We're dealing with an in-custody defendant. Mark cites to the statute requiring or giving them 15 days to file their paperwork or the information. I'm still not sure that requires an initial appearance within 15 days. I think that may be a different, the amount of time that the DA's office is afforded to get their work completed. So when you talk about a time frame, Judge Shirley, are you talking about a time frame from the point in which the justice court has made the bind over determination, or from the time that the DA's office gets the file? What time?
Well, I would like some. The problem is we don't know what's going on in justice court, right? If we get some kind of notice.
Excuse me, Judge. Someone needs to put their phone on mute. We're hearing a lot of background noise.
If we got notice that there was a bind over on Monday, let's say, then we factor in how long the DA has to file their information, we could schedule an arraignment accordingly so that it happened as soon as possible after the information should be filed. There are some great advantages to a rule that would do that too, in that if they're not going to file it, we can get rid of the case. I mean, if they don't do it within the 15 days and, or at least come in and ask for an extension, then we can move those cases forward. They won't fall through the cracks.
Judge, if I could just ask one additional question. Judge, in the counties other than Douglas, have there been grand jury indictments returned, or is that a rare or unused practice in the other rural counties?
I think it's pretty rare.
Okay. All right. Justice Silver, you were going to ask a question?
I guess I was just going to ask, with the in-custody bindovers, as far as the Clark County DA, the criminal complaints are already in the computer as far as what the charges are. So I guess I'm unclear why it takes a whole week just to file an information or to change chart. I mean, I could see changing some charges or deleting or adding, but why it would take so long if you already have that template in the computer. And then there's a second part of it. The Justice Court does the bindover package. So that's different from the DA's, unless I'm missing something. Besides the information, what does the DA have to provide to the district court on the bindover?
Justice, the challenge is not our office. We easily file informations in 2 days. That is not the issue. What I did was simply call to our team chiefs to find out, which is a judicial function, how long it takes from the day of bindover until they're appearing in district court. And in all of those, North Las Vegas, Henderson, all of the rural courts, it's 5 days or more.
Who creates?
I can tell you,
Chris, I'm sorry if you could add to your answer. Who creates that period of time in the out of those courts?
The courts, right?
I believe it's the courts. So what occurred in Las Vegas Justice Court and the district court, the 8th Judicial District Court, happened probably maybe 5 years ago or so. Judge Barker was the chief judge at the time. And basically what he did is he brought the IT teams together for both district court and justice court because of the jail overcrowding issue. It was taking much longer than that. I think it was taking at the time an average of 10 days. And we all rolled up our sleeves and said, let's figure out a way to make this bindover happen in 2 days. And the reason for that was to save on jail space, because it was just dead jail time. And we did that, but it just involves those two courts. And I can tell you, as we speak, there are some IT issues that are going on between those two courts where we'll file an information and the district court doesn't have for us a district court case number. So they are scrambling right now, the district court is, to meet that court date. I'm hopeful that this issue is resolved soon, but I can tell you every day I hear from a secretary who's tried to file an information in district court and we're not able to do so because district court doesn't have a case number generated for that case yet. So I'm just very concerned that these timeframes are more aggressive than we can practically meet. And when I say we, I say all of us as a system. Again, in response to Justice Silver's question, we're filing informations in 2 days. That's not an issue for us.
Yeah, that was my question, because I knew the DAs, I mean, you could get anything filed the next day. So it's got to be really the limited, it's the jurisdictions, as far as the limited justices of the peace, getting the paperwork and the packets and everything generated. Thanks for clarifying that.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Mark, you wanted to be heard.
I do, and this goes more towards Justice Silver. I don't know how much of an issue it is, obviously, in Washoe or Clark. They have teams, they have specialized teams, they have different tracks. The rules were all different. And I, although I used to practice in pretty much all of the rules and have a pretty good idea how a lot of those rurals work between their justice courts and their district courts. But here in Douglas County are two justice courts. One holds the evidentiary hearings of prelims on a Thursday. One holds it on a Friday. Our district court department two has law in motion and arraignments and sentencings on Monday. The other one has it on Tuesday. You can be in a preliminary hearing, get done late on a Friday with court that following Monday based upon the bind over, because if it's bound over, it's going to be bound over on that Monday or that Tuesday. And while the charging document can be very similar to the complaint, nevertheless, it is a different document. It does require the endorsement of the witnesses that you anticipate calling. I do prefer that my prosecutor spend some time reflecting on that as opposed to listing 100 people just because they're named in the report, to actually try to anticipate who you truly likely plan on calling at the time. So there is some time that I ask my prosecutors to put into their informations to correct things that could occur during the course of the preliminary hearing, some amendments and stuff. It's just not a simple thing about asking someone to push a button and generate a brand new document. So for Douglas County, the three judicial days, it's contrary to a statute that allows us, again, while you could have an initial appearance, you won't have an arraignment, and then you're doubling up, you know, back-to-back weeks between an initial appearance and then coming back. The way this rule reads, unless waived by the defendant, the initial appearance and arraignment shall be scheduled within these time periods. So I know there's very similar reasons in the other rules, much like what Judge Shirley talked about, where they don't have a law in motion in a certain county every week. So I don't know if there's a separation of the rules or otherwise, but I don't think we can look past the fact that this is contrary to what our existing law is.
Okay, so let me circle back to this. It underscores again the issue of the determination of the pretrial detention status of a defendant who is sitting in jail for many days, sounds like, potentially many days, while the court system is, all of the system is trying to get them into the district court for a hearing. I think it's clear that reasonable arguments exist that a defendant's detention status should be evaluated sooner than 15 days, for sure. That's the area why these deadlines were discussed. So if we're going to have a rule that looks like what was adopted in Rule 4, then it seems like there needs to be a separate, earlier detention assessment of the defendant's status, particularly where that hasn't occurred before, where that hasn't taken place in justice court. I'd like to hear from the committee about that issue. This gets back to Darren's question earlier and what happens when there's no parallel proceeding and there's simply a complaint and an indictment or a date of bind over of the defendant and you move directly into the district court without having had that.
And this is Luke Prangeman, and it seems to me like that is the heart of the issue, is capturing, because that's where the timing is really necessary for all the information defendants. I think in Washoe, we typically are not meeting 3 days. I mean, we're not taking 15 days, but we're not meeting three. But it seems like it's those indictment defendants who are either arrested with no parallel proceeding, or there's a parallel proceeding, but the change of circumstances, the bail is set differently on the indictment. So maybe I would suggest maybe that we omit reference to information defendants, because I don't perceive that there's a huge issue with timing in the various jurisdictions, and that maybe in subsection C, where we deal with indictment, we provide that if a defendant is arrested or has a change of circumstances, in those two instances, the arraignment and initial appearance must be within 3 judicial days. So that addresses the key situations where timing is necessary, that 3 days or that prompt hearing is necessary, and these are the jurisdictions which it sounds like are, again, I would suggest there's not a huge problem with the timing for information defendants on those findovers. Then there'd be no inconsistency with the rule on the informations. Because in Washoe, if we theoretically could have those arraignments on information defendants in 3 days, many of them will not have informations filed necessarily, or the guilty plea memos that go along with them for the entry of plea, which can also take some time. And for the majority of cases, those go hand in hand. And so it does take some time to generate a guilty plea memo for the majority of defendants who will be entering guilty pleas. And so we're not going to hit that 3 days, and then that hearing is just going to get continued until the information is filed. So again, I think we could omit that safely. That would be my suggestion. I do have a suggestion too, that I don't want to get us off the topic of the timing, but I have a suggestion on subsection C when it's appropriate, Justice.
Okay. Yes, Jonelle.
Yeah, so I have a couple of thoughts. The first is, and Darren and Christopher could correct me if I'm wrong here, this doesn't happen a lot in my cases, but my understanding is there are a fair number of cases in which the defendant is going to be let out of custody as soon as he enters a plea in district court. And then, so in those cases, holding someone for 15 days instead of 2 or 3 days is going to make a big difference on jail population and a big difference on that person's quality of life and ability to get back to work. And I would hate to see that drawn out to 15 days. On subsection 3, dealing with the Department of Corrections, presumably the client is going to be in custody on some other charge if he's within the prison system, right?
Yep.
So unless this is someone who's getting released from prison and then being brought to court, I don't have heartburn over extending the 15 days to deal with transportation issues.
Okay, thank you. Darren, did you... or John Petty or John Arascata, did you hear Luke's comments about separating indictment and information defendants, and do you have a comment about that?
This is John Arascata. Luke's quality wasn't that good, but I tend to agree with the separation of indictment versus information. I think we're dealing with two separate topics and separate custodial status situations. So I think from what I heard, I tend to agree with Luke's suggestion.
Mr. Derrick, the quality was hard to hear and hard to understand. My only concern with changing the two is most of the indictments are from a parallel proceeding. And so it's just going to extend the amount of time that someone would be in justice court. My preference is leave it as it is and adopt it the way it is.
Okay. Any other comments regarding Luke's suggestion?
This is Christopher Lawley. I'm in agreement with Luke's proposal.
Someone was attempting to speak just before Chris spoke. Who was that, Luke or?
John Springate.
Oh, sorry, John. Go ahead, sir.
Yeah. As well as I could hear Luke and certainly John Arascotta, I tend to agree, too. They are entirely separate matters. On most of the information cases, we've already had the bail conditions or OR at Justice Court. So I agree with John and with Luke. They really should be separated and dealt with in that regard.
Okay.
Justice Hardesty?
Yes.
If I just jump in for a second, I think the concern I have in it, and it stems from back when I was at the second, is that it seems unconscionable to keep someone in 2 weeks after their bind over, especially when the bind over, without seeing a judge, when the bind over, at least in Washoe, usually is because there's been a waiver of prelim, which means instead of the 18 charges you went into the prelim with, you've agreed to plead to one of them. So you're going across the street to either enter that plea pursuant to a plea agreement, or as Justice Silver had pointed out earlier, responding to an information that is largely the same as the criminal document that you originally went to prelim on. It just seems that we should be able to do that faster and not kind of shift the cost and the time onto the sheriff and onto the defendants for us moving paperwork. Because what we're talking about is paperwork that is keeping these people from getting in front of a judge, or in some instances, convenience. Because I know in the second, it's the judges that pick their bind over date, whatever date they put in the computer. And that can sometimes be, well, I'm going to be out 3 weeks. I'm going to be on vacation. I don't want anyone else doing my cases. So I'm going to put my bind over date here. And the justice courts just put it on those bind over dates. So I just think that we can do better. Whether this rule process is going to be the place that helps us do better or not, or it has to be a statute change, I just think we can do better in pushing that many in custody additional bed days. Is doesn't seem to me to be just, frankly. That's it.
Justice, this is Darren again. One of the problems that was just mentioned is with an information and a bind over, there's been a Valdez-Jimenez determination made in justice court. On a case that's indicted, the person may not appear in front of a judge for 10 to 15 days and has never had any kind of determination made as to their custody status. And so they need to be seen as quickly as possible because they never had that opportunity.
Yeah, that's the point I was trying to highlight, Darren.
This is Hangman. Oh, sorry, was someone speaking?
I'm sorry, I was going to say to Mr. Emily, I agree, but I think everybody should be brought, especially anybody in custody, should be brought in front of a magistrate in the district court ASAP. But it's not just things change pretty dramatically from justice court to district court because most of these are pleas. So the case that you're going to plead to is very, very different than the one you waived prelim on. It's not so much the ones where somebody goes to a preliminary hearing and they're bound over. If they're bound over on all the same charges, they've seen a magistrate. But when somebody's going to waive it and move forward, generally you're waiving it because the case is very different. You're going to plead to one, not all the other charges. Oftentimes it's a reduced charge. So the case that's being presented, the case that is justifying your continued detention, is very different than the one that you had before you went into justice court.
Agreed.
Luke, were you wanting to weigh in just before Justice Stiglitz finished her remarks?
Thank you, Justice. And just to Mr. Imlay's point, but I would propose that we address specifically what he's talking about, those defendants for whom. So the three categories of a pure indictment with a defendant who's not been arrested or there's no parallel proceeding, the defendant for whom there is a parallel proceeding, but there's a change in circumstances in the bail or the conditions of release have been increased, or for whatever reason there hasn't been a prior prompt determination. I mean, that's what I'm proposing, is that we would address those three circumstances. So the defendant that he's talking about would be afforded within 3 days that arraignment, which I perceive that to be the main issue for this. And so I would propose similar language. In fact, I think if we go back to the original language regarding indictments and tweak it a little and address those three and say that the court, instead of saying a prompt adversarial hearing, say the court shall conduct the arraignment and first appearance within 3 days, I think that would solve it for those particular defendants. But again, to Justice Stiglitz's point, I would submit that the fix, I don't disagree with anything Justice Stiglitz said, but I think that's a legislative fix, not necessarily one for rule, or at least I would suggest that.
Why? Why not resolve this by rule?
Well, Justice, one reason is practical. I think there's two parts to that I would suggest. One is what you've heard discussed, which is it's going to be hard to find a one-size-fits-all rule for all jurisdictions, which is kind of our purpose in these rules, and we, with few exceptions, stuck to that, something that applies to everyone. And I think in a big jurisdiction, highly computerized like Clark, they may be able to get those documents on file quickly. I think in Washoe, I think we have, I would say, you know, I don't like to say it, but I think we have an unfortunate degree of sort of typos and things like that in our documents. And part of that is already because people are trying to rush. There's a push to get things rushed. And so, and again, like Mr. Jackson said, you're sitting down. It's not a matter, or I would hope something as serious as this is not a matter of just pushing keys and printing out another document. It does require some thought. You're putting together a guilty plea memo. You want to make sure that those documents are accurate. And I think we're in Washoe not going to hit 3 days with our volume doing that to get those out. Well, and most of those cases are involved guilty plea memos as well. We could come up with I'm sorry, Justice.
No, go ahead. Finish your thought. Sorry.
I was just going to say, so we could come up with a time frame that's reasonable for Washoe. It's not, I would suggest not 3 days. It's less than 10 days, but not as few as three. But I don't know that that's going to work for all the other jurisdictions. And the bottom line is the state has 15 days to file the information. And so, again, for the vast majority, 97, 98, 90, maybe even 99% of the defendants who are by information and the vast majority of those who are going to plead guilty with a guilty plea memorandum, if those documents aren't ready, that's about all that occurs at the arraignment. They're going to enter their plea, and so that if those documents aren't on file, it's just going to get continued. So I would suggest whatever, if the committee, again, I think that's a legislative change. I think that there's a separation of powers issue there where the legislature has provided that time frame. But
well,
the committee, sorry, Justice.
Go ahead, finish your thought.
Just that if the committee is set on doing that, I would suggest that we need to come up with something that is reasonable, a reasonable lowest common denominator for every jurisdiction that everyone can meet getting both the defendants and the documents to court. That's all. Thank you, Justice.
Yeah, so let me express a slightly different viewpoint about whether you handle this by rule or by statute, because part of the problem identified by Chris, identified by Justice Stiglitz, identified by others, is in the court system, the court system's processing of this paperwork. Now, that is an issue. If we are causing defendants to lag in jail pending the resolution of a guilty plea because the court system can't set it, or if we have a judge who's setting a bindover 3 weeks out as a matter of convenience to that judge, that's not acceptable. That's just not acceptable. So I understand that there are staffing concerns and that sort of thing. But the fact of the matter is, these cases should be processed in a time frame that is really governed by court rules. And I submit that there's quite a bit of jurisprudence that supports the point that the court's management of its cases is governed by court rules. So I think we need to find a way to address this. I agree with your suggestion, Luke, that you could separate this out if you, I want to ask Darren a question though. Darren, going to Rule 5, if you look at those three subparts, what I hear Luke saying is inserting some time frames into a couple of those that you expressed a concern about. In order, forget the arraignment, just focus on the initial appearance. That's what I hear Luke saying. Do I get that right, Luke?
Justice, I think you could do that. I would actually do it in Rule 4, and I would do it in what's now subsection C, which I think would become subsection B if we were to move it down. But I would do it there just because it is addressing directly the first appearance, where the other rule is addressing what happens, basically grand jury proceeding.
Okay. Darren, I asked you.
I'm still in agreement with the three judicial days. I think I would make a motion that we adopt Rule 4 and 5 as written, as submitted.
Okay. We'll see if there is a second for that. Is there a second for that motion?
I second that motion. This is Janelle.
Okay. All right. Kimberly, would you take the role of the group?
Justice Hardesty?
I'm going to vote no at this time because I want to allow other members of the committee to submit alternatives for consideration, as has been requested, to address the concerns we've been talking about here.
Justice Silver?
I was going to vote yes, but after listening to all of the comments, I'm in agreement with Justice Hardesty to see others' proposals before I vote.
Justice Stiglitz?
I echo Justice Silver's comments, so I guess it's no at this time.
John Arascotta?
Yes.
Judge Freeman?
No, for the same reasons spoken by the Supreme.
Judge Herndon? I think you're on mute, Judge Herndon. I'm going to come back to
Hello?
You. Oh, go ahead.
Hello? Oh, good. I just said I'm going to abstain. I was doing a couple of search warrants, so I didn't catch everything. I'm sorry.
Okay. Darren Imlay?
Yes.
Mark Jackson?
No.
Chris Lawley?
No.
Luke Pringleman?
No.
Lisa Rasmussen?
Yes.
Judge Shirley?
No.
John Springate?
No.
And Jonelle Thomas?
Yes.
The noes have it.
Okay, so here's what I'd like to suggest. I don't know if anybody else would like to submit an alternative to the subject we've been discussing in Rule 4 or 5, but we'll invite that to be submitted within 10 days. And then I'll circulate those alternatives to the group. If we don't get a majority vote, then we'll submit all of those alternatives with the rest of the rules to the Supreme Court. But I think it's time to bring this matter to a close. So anyone can submit a proposal, and we'll circulate those by email and invite people to vote on those alternatives, including the ones that are in front of us now. I will say that whatever submissions are made should take into account the concerns that have been expressed by Justice Stiglitch and others regarding getting this process moving. Addressing the fact that we do not want people to be in custody following a plea and for an undue amount of time. So I'll leave it at that. I don't think there are any other pending rules beyond this subject. So let's invite whatever suggestions people have for rule amendments. Please mark on your calendar. 10 days from today is going to be we'll make it October the 5th. That's a hard deadline. By 4 o'clock, please. And then Jamie will circulate a vote on those alternatives on the 6th. Okay, any questions or comments?
Justice Harsey, I had a couple questions. Mm-hmm. Sharon Dickinson. Mm-hmm. When everybody was talking, I thought you had said something about there's a difference between what happens in justice court and district court. And if that's what you said, I was wondering what you were referencing. We were talking about the Valdez hearings, Valdez Jimenez.
I was referencing the fact, Sharon, that the rules that we are working on here are rules governing the district court's conduct of its cases, not the justice court's conduct of its cases. And that I was letting the group know that there was some interest among the Limited Jurisdiction Association to examine whether there should be rules of criminal procedure in the justice courts. In terms of the determination of bail and release and detention status, those processes are governed by statute, are governed by case law, but I am focusing on rules in the district court that pick up the defendant's status at the point the defendant enters the district court system. That's what I was referencing.
Oh, and then I had another question.
Okay.
I was looking at Rule 6 that Luke Praman had put together. Rule 6, which says in our original packet, release and detention pending judicial proceedings, which I think is now our Rule 5. And when I was looking at that, I saw there's an 8th Judicial District Rule 3.80 that talks about a individual being released from custody based on one district judge making an emergency release. So in this rule is not contained within the current Rule 5.
That's correct.
This rule I know I've used in the past. We had an incident years and years ago where someone was arrested on a warrant that was supposed to have been removed from the books, and it wasn't. We had proof of that. And at that time, Morgan Harris was in charge of the public defender's office, and he was able to get the parties, you know, the district court judge and the jail and everybody to go back and look at this and get the person out of custody. So this rule is helpful, but I notice it's now gone.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want to have this rule. I think it's an important rule if there is a problem with the paperwork and somebody's held in custody unnecessarily.
So as a follow-on, we've also had some Judicial Discipline Commission issues surface as a result of ex parte communication between district court judges and people who've been released from custody. That's why it's not there.
Okay. So if somebody's, if there's a problem with the paperwork and they're arrested, they just have to wait there till we are, whenever we can get them into court?
That's right. Or you can call the DA's office or get a stipulation, but ex parte communications with district court judges in cases in which nobody's even heard anything dealing with the case raises some ethical questions for the judges.
And then I had one other question. When you were talking about the time period between the indictment and 3 days later, the initial appearance and arraignment, were you referencing also that there's a possibility there could be a time in between there where there would be a Valdez-Jimenez hearing if nobody had had a hearing before? I know we spoke about this, I thought it was at the last meeting, because somebody asked, well, how come we don't have the public defender or the defense attorneys when the indictments return so we can address custody issues then? And I think Mr. Lally said, well, you know, all that's supposed to be secret. So I don't know if there's still the possibility of having people show up there and have a hearing in those limited instances.
That's what we've been discussing, Sharon, are those instances in which the detention status of the defendant set in a pending proceeding was changed by the district court judge on return of the true bill, or instances in which the defendant enters the district court system through an indictment and there's been no parallel proceeding. And those are the areas that Luke has commented about and others have commented about where an initial appearance time frame probably needs to be addressed as opposed to an arraignment. I don't know if that answers your question, but that's my understanding of the discussion.
Okay. Yeah, I wasn't sure if he was suggesting they do it when they return the indictment or not. I mean, it seems like we already have a hearing going on there. That would be an easy fix.
Well, here's the problem. In the 8th Judicial District, as I get it, the return of the indictment can vary between 2 days and, Chris, 5 to 7 days, it sounds like, more likely 7 calendar days anyway, depending upon what justice court or where it comes from. Is that right?
Justice, you said indictment. I think you mean information.
Yeah, I did say indictment. I meant information.
That is correct.
Okay. The representation I received from Judge Bell is that all in-custody indictments are being heard in 2 days in Clark County.
Again, Justice, I think you mean information.
No, I mean indictments. I mean that specifically. I'm looking at her email.
So what I can tell you, indictments are certainly different. So we will appear at an indictment return hearing, and we file our indictment. And I don't know when defendants are appearing in district court for their arraignments, but I would agree with Judge Bell that is much, much faster than a bindover from justice court.
Okay. So your question
and, I'm sorry, Justice, and I don't perceive the time frame in the proposed rule that we saw today as being problematic with respect to indictments.
Okay. All right, anything further?
Justice Artis, it's Judge Shirley again.
Mm-hmm.
I want to correct a comment I made earlier about what the Justice's Court duty is. In our NRS 171.206, the last sentence, it says the magistrate shall transmit forthwith to the clerk of the district court all papers in the proceedings and any bail. So they do have, they have a forthwith, which my interpretation is as quickly as possible.
That's exactly right, Judge, and that's why we are, I get the feeling that we're like a couple of ships passing in the night. Once this case is in the judicial system and the justice court has an obligation under the statute to get its stuff over to the district court, that's the time frame we're focusing on. Now, I get that there are secretaries who are stressed and there's staff who's stressed and there's procedures that need to be taken into account, and we need to look at all of that. But it is problematic that a defendant sits in jail while the court system's paperwork is taking 1, 2, 3 weeks to get to a bindover judge. That's not acceptable. That's what we want to address. And to the extent that a defendant has not had a Valdez-Jimenez hearing, for sure that needs to be addressed way earlier than those timeframes. So I'm inviting people to offer alternative drafts or suggestions. We'll look at them and vote on them, or based on these conversations, we'll pass along what we have here, and the court can deliberate on it, and you can share your comments to the rest of the Supreme Court. Of course, you can do that anyway. But I think we've debated this long enough. We know what the problems are. I selected 3 judicial days, the time frame I was primarily focused on was that time frame from when the justice court has to get its stuff over to the district court. And I understand in Clark County, in those outer line townships, that may present a problem. Mark, I don't know if the time period you're talking about has already been addressed, your 15-day period. We're talking about the obligation of the justice court once the bindover has been determined. So I don't see that 15-day period you're talking about being implicated. But I do think that a point has been made that, as we know, defendants shouldn't be taking up jail space. And frankly, the case law that we've developed so far, that has developed so far, would require a prompt adjudication of the defendant's custody status if they haven't had that before. So drafts that accommodate those objectives are what is what we're looking at. Sharon?
Harney, I have another question based on what you were saying. When an indictment is returned, the paperwork is already in the district court. So in that sense, the 3-day judicial days of arrest for an indictment, we don't need to wait for the paperwork to get there. Is that correct?
Right. That's why the word arrest is in the draft.
Right. So if somebody's arrested and the paperwork's already there, they technically could be brought to court earlier than 3 days because the paperwork's there, they're there. Nothing else to wait on.
Well, we've had this debate about how quickly they have to be brought before a district court judge. And if you compare this to our magistrate statute, 72 hours is the outside date. So that's why that was selected.
Thank you.
Okay. Anything further for today? Justice Silver, we can't hear you.
When's the next meeting? I got the dates that they're supposed to have the proposed rules in, but do we have a date for our next meeting?
There won't be another meeting.
Okay.
We're done. If you take a look at tab 6, We have addressed all of the rules that the committee chose to address. We have not had an official report from Justice Stiglitch. So Justice, if you're on the phone, could you comment about the jury commissioner work you were looking at? I think you, in a separate email, you had communicated to me that after your follow-up, you did not feel it was necessary to develop a rule for jury commissioner selection. Are you there, Justice Stiglitch? Hello? Justice Stiglitch, are you there?
Justice Hardesty, it looks like she just dropped off the call.
Okay, so I will read an email dated September 17th.
She got disconnected. I'm sorry, she just texted me back. She just got disconnected and she's trying to get back. Sorry, Justice.
Okay, we'll wait just a second.
Yeah, hold on, back. Okay, she's trying.
This is Darren Emily. On the other rules then, are those gonna be sent out to us? We'll just send an email as which one we vote for?
As to 4 and 5, yes. On the chart, this chart here that you all have under tab 6, if you can see it, that identifies the status of all the other rules that we passed and will be forwarded through a separate administrative docket petition after we give you the results of the vote on 4 and 5.
Thank you.
Justice Hardesty, on tab 5 dealing with the administrative orders, I didn't see anything from the second JD and was curious about that with the jury questionnaire issue that we discussed last time.
So that's why I wanted Justice Stiglitch to be on this. She led that effort and she can respond to that question when she connects.
Justice Hardesty, I'm back on. Justice Stiglitch. Sorry. The minute you started talking to me, the thing started spinning saying network issues. So it might be divine intervention. I'm not sure. But what I was tasked with was checking to see if there were any AOs that related to the jury commissioner, the jury process in any of the districts. Ms. Gradick and I reached out to all of the jurisdictions. We heard from everybody except the 5th and the 9th, I believe, unless Ms. Gradick updates that. I heard from the 2nd and the 8th. She heard from the rurals. And nobody has any AOs that relate to that topic. So I maintain my original position. I don't think that we need a rule on that.
And Mr. Jackson, we hadn't heard from the 9th, but I understood maybe from an email that they don't have any administrative orders either dealing with jury commission, jury selection. Is that right?
There are no AOs here in the 9th regarding those topics.
Okay. All right.
Justice Hardesty, I guess I remain confused because I thought there was a second JD administrative order dealing with confidentiality of jury questionnaires. I assume that's still in place.
Judge Freeman, are you on the call?
I think John Arascotta said it best our last session when John Arascotta articulated for you, Ms. Thomas, that there previously had been some controversy related to that issue. And there is a destruction order in place from my predecessor from 3 chief judges ago that the questionnaires after utilization are to be destroyed. And I believe John Arascotta explained it to all of us. I wasn't aware of it. That's the only order that I'm aware of. And it wasn't a recent administrative order. And it certainly wasn't an administrative order related to COVID times. It was having to do with particular case and compromise that occurred a number of years ago. Best answer I have.
And my understanding, and I thought it was supported by Mr. Pregerman at the last meeting, was that the order said that counsel were required to submit their copies to the court clerk, and that if the public wanted to look at those copies, they had to make a showing of why it was necessary. And if that's the case, I think it is something that we should address.
I haven't seen that before me. And since I've been the chief, no one's made that request. I'm not familiar with that requirement. I don't know if Mr. Arascot is still on the line.
Or Luke.
I am, and Judge Freeman's correct. That came out from, that order came out from, actually Judge McGee was the chief judge in like 1996, I wanna say was the case. I think though that that administrative order is now in conflict with that Supreme Court case, and the name's slipping me right now, Sunrise Media, I think it is. So it may be something to look at, Judge Freeman, as far as removing it, because it might be in conflict with that Supreme Court ruling.
Yeah, I certainly haven't had that issue.
Yeah, it just by way of history, the administrative order generated because in a trial previous to the one I was going to try, an attorney had tried to contact a former juror. That former juror contacted the chief judge directly, and he had issued an order that no one receives jury questionnaires. We filed a writ. This ruling then that administrative order was entered. But as to the effect that from 1996 to now that it may be contrary to law, it may need to be revisited.
Judge Freeman, could you look into that and get back to us on it?
Sure.
Okay. Anything else, Janelle? Okay. All right, then I'd like to thank everyone for your service on the committee and for your work here. As I mentioned before, we will file a petition with the court once we've gotten past where we are with Rule 4 and 5. And those materials, along with this graph and the votes taken, will be submitted to the court so it is aware of the deliberations and the timing and the like for each of the different rules. And a request will be made for the Chief Justice to set a public hearing on the rules as developed by the committee and recommended by the committee. Thank you on behalf of the court, on behalf of Justice Stiglitz and Justice Silver for your service in this regard. I really appreciate it. As always, it's an honor and a privilege to work with all of you on the various matters that exist within the criminal justice system and in the legal system. And I can't begin to tell you how much I respect all of your opinions and your input in this process. So thank you very much. I was looking at our pending ADKTs in the Supreme Court and noticed that I think this committee began a little over 4 or 4.5, maybe years ago. So much has been accomplished, I think, in the last year and a half, and it's all due to your efforts. So thank you everybody for your participation. I don't know that we're entirely completed. There may be some things that come out of the deliberations with the court where we need to circle back to the committee. That happened, I think, in a few cases with some of the rules of civil procedure. So no releases or excuse, and thank you and excused yet. But we may be back for further conversations once we get the discussions and public hearing in front of the Supreme Court and see if there are any inquiries the court wants us to follow up with. So thank you all very much for your involvement. Really appreciate it. And once again, please submit your either edits or alternatives to 4 and 5, and we'll circulate those. They may get submitted collectively as a group, or there may be a vote that is establishes a preference. If anybody has any questions in the meantime, or if there is a reason to hold a meeting, we certainly can do that. Please let me know and what the agenda is or what the concern is, and we'll call a meeting to address that. Obviously, we can put together these Zoom meetings relatively easy. But thank you for your time today, and thanks for all your work on the committee. Enjoy the rest of your afternoon, your week. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you, Justin.
Bye.
Thank you.